Okay, well, it's an irony of history that the birth of supposedly enlightened capitalism in Europe was marked by witch trials carried out by both religious and secular courts, endorsed by states and taken up by zealous witch hunters. Torture, heresy hunting, inquisitions, burning people alive were all present at the birth of the brave new world of capitalism. And I think for anyone at this conference familiar with the modern crimes of capitalism, this shouldn't be too surprising. As Marx said, it came into the world dripping from head to toe, from every pore with blood and dirt. Colonialism, slavery, massive land enclosures and impoverishment were all, I think, absolutely necessary to usher in the world of markets, trade, science and supposed freedom that Adam Smith and others talked so glowingly about, including that freedom from property, which Marx described as the condition of the working class. Now, for anyone who knows a little bit about the witch trials in this period, in the early modern period, they spanned basically the 16th century, so the sort of mid-1500s, and went for about 200 years. The gendered nature of the witch trials is one of the most striking things about them. It's why we have things like Sabrina the Witch and whatever, all those kind of pop culture things that where, you know, witches are almost always women. Because in reality, in Europe, in most places, they were on average between 75 and 80% women. Now, this seems to point pretty clearly towards a connection between the rise of capitalism and witch hunting, and historian, and in particular how that may have reconfigured the position of women in society. And historians have been intrigued by this since at least the 1960s. But this talk is about Silvia Federici's central claim in her recent book, Witches, Witch Hunting and Women, which is basically a rehashing of something she wrote in 1998 in Caliban and the Witch, that claim being that the witch hunts were just as necessary for the development of capitalism as were colonies, slavery, and enclosures. And a series of questions flow from this alleged connection between the birth of capitalism and the witch trials. How did the position of women change or even worsen in the transition from feudalism, the feudal social relations, to capitalism? And were the witch trials central to that? And also, does that tell you something about the social position of women under capitalism? Now, this talk is basically aimed at critically discussing Federici's answers to some of these questions. I did want to start by contextualising Federici herself, because in reading this stuff, I found that actually many, many, many people have written about witches before and since Federici. And the witch, I think, exists in the imagination as much as it did in the real world. I mean, actually, I should say witches are not real. That is no, honestly, you sometimes have to clarify that. That is the premise of my talk, is that they were not real, but they were a demonised and persecuted section of society. But they did not really ride around on broomsticks. But a certain witch obsession descended on parts of the Western left in the late 1960s, and I think it's really remained there to this day. In 1968, as the movements for women's and sexual liberation and black power were kicking off across America, radical women in New York named their new organisation WITCH, which stood for Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell. In the academy, women historians were delving into the annals of 16th century witch hunting, rereading the misogynistic 1487 text of the Malleus Maleficarum, and attempting to explain the origins of women's current oppression through analysis of something that happened 600 years prior. Since then, many feminists have clung to the witch hunting story. It has become that cruel historical moment that stretched over centuries when women's innate power and knowledge was taken from them and male capitalism was stamped across Europe. When the female healers became male doctors, when the abortionist was outlawed, when the woman artisan and herbalist were robbed of their lands, and when the sexually liberated woman became the appendage of man. The witch became the symbol of everything womanly, wild, and anti-capitalist, the untamed, sexual, earthly woman who capitalism had to uproot, silence, murder, and condemn to the home. And many feminist groups have proudly called themselves witches as a reclamation of what capitalism allegedly tried to destroy. And it gets weirder because many feminists actually tried to become real witches, and that is a global trend across the world, I'm told. People thinking they can cast hexes and, you know, actually wearing witches' hats and bring potions, and generally trying to recreate what is a now very mythologised lifestyle of the European pagan that I think had very little to do with what how anyone actually lived back then. So there's a new religion called witchcraft or Wicca that has, I'm told, 600,000 adherents in America alone. But again, it's entirely modern and invented through readings of the kind of texts about the witch hunts rather than any actual religion. As the literary critic Diane Purkis wrote, radical feminists needed a Holocaust of their own. And there are many radical feminists who indeed compared the witch hunts to the Holocaust. They needed a moment when women became subjugated, robbed of their power, and became the victims of mass killings. And they chose the 16th and 17th century witch hunts as this kind of moment, sometimes inflating the numbers killed into the millions to this end. And Federici does this a little bit. She doesn't say millions because it's just totally untenable as a number, but she says hundreds of thousands, which I think is actually dubious as well. Now, Federici's work, I don't say all of this to totally discredit her from the start. I don't think that would be fair, but I do think that her work is part of this radical feminist tradition and has to be understood in that way, although it definitely has a Marxist flavour. And I wanted to mention this because I think sometimes the symbolism of the witch clouds Federici and other radical feminist historical analysis just as much as the male chauvinism of often a lot of male historians has distorted their views of this period as well. So I'm going to try to stick to the known facts about what actually happened and analyse what Federici says on that basis. A little bit about Federici, because I, again, do not want to just discredit her from the beginning. She is a radical, autonomous, Marxist feminist. It's a lengthy label that is very popular in her home of Italy, and her analysis blends elements of Foucault, Marx, and radical feminism. And she strongly rejects like the pro-capitalist strains of feminism. She always ties her position to the necessity for radical struggle against the system. She always stands on the side of the oppressed. And doesn't get caught up in the kind of supposed feminism that, lauds the successes of rich women or goes along with racist campaigns in the name of liberating women, like the so-called feminists that supported the Afghanistan war. Now, she argues that the witch hunts were a necessary part of primitive accumulation. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get fairly academic at this point. Primitive accumulation is a Marxist concept which describes the process by which an emerging capitalist class accumulates capital, so accumulates the vast amounts of wealth that were pushed, created the kind of global market that we know today, and at the same time created the working class by dispossessing masses of peasants, essentially forcing them off their land. As Marx says, those moments when great masses of men are suddenly and forcibly torn from their means of subsistence and hurled as free and unattached proletarians on the labour market. Now, I want to start my analysis by talking about Marx and primitive accumulation and what Federici has to say about them. Not because I just want to desperately defend Marxism from Federici, but it is her starting point, actually, in both of her books, in Caliban and the Witch, and in her more recent one as well. Now, her claim is that she's adding a crucial element to the story of European primitive accumulation and the birth of capitalism. And she says that Marx basically leaves that out, and that is the subjugation of women via the witch trials. In Capital, Marx describes the process of primitive accumulation, i.e. that initial burst of capital accumulation which made the system possible. And he says capitalism is a system where the great mass of people have no property and must sell their labour as a commodity on the market. And the bosses who own most of the means of production buy this labour power and exploit the human beings who expend it. So as a necessary condition, you have to separate millions of people from their means of subsistence, so basically their means of surviving on the land, of eating and whatever, any land and tools that they might have to be able to survive, you have to rob them of that so that they have no choice but to sell themselves to the people who, a tiny minority of people who now own most of the wealth. Okay, and this is the process that we probably know quite well from the history books. To accumulate the wealth in raw materials and land that could fuel trade and manufacturing required the horrors of colonial expansion and slavery. Millions of Africans were enslaved to produce cotton, sugar and iron, which powered the mills and factories of England, in which new propertyless wage slaves laboured for an absolute pittance. And all of this fueled the growth of industry and the ability of a tiny, irrelevant island called England to create an unprecedented military force that could essentially conquer half of the globe within a century. And that's why, you know, we all speak English in this room. Marx talked a lot about the morally reprehensible mode of capitalism's birth, but according to Federici, that's not enough. She says, basically, that she accuses Marx of not thinking, well, of thinking that capitalism was basically a good step forward for humanity, and she really rejects this. Now, Marx did say that it was a step forward for humanity, not because it wasn't a horrific process, which he outlines in a lot of detail, but because the creation of a massive working class, the creation of collective social labour on a mass scale, and the huge abundance of wealth that capitalism creates, but also, you know, keeps in the hands of a tiny minority, that paved the way for human liberation. I'll start with Federici's argument now. So her argument is tenfold. Basically, that women's subjugation was absolutely necessary to complete primitive accumulation in Europe. The witch hunts represent to her the pointy end of this subjugation. She points out that this happened all across Europe, not just in England. You know, a lot of people know about the witch hunts in England, but it happened all across Europe by secular courts and states of every religion. So Catholics, Orthodox Church, Lutherans and Calvinists. Land enclosures, she says, created huge layers of impoverished people, particularly disrupted women's and older women's claims to land and power. She says that the witch hunts were used to defeat the threat posed by the expropriated commoners turned vagabonds, beggars and landless labourers ready to revolt against the new master. So the witch hunts were partly about terrorising this newly landless peasant class into submission. She also says that the control of women's sexuality and the imposition of the family was necessary to reproduce a working class, and that the witch hunts helped to impose these norms. So for capitalism, women could not be in control of their sexuality, they could not carry out abortions, could not be midwives, and so on. Mm-hmm. She says that capitalism required the destruction of the power of women as well, and that this was achieved through the extermination of the witches. This is, again, her argument. Prior to the witch hunts, she says that women had power as folk healers, as abortionists, midwives, and peasant landowners as well. In terms of those professions, they were all displaced by male practitioners, and women lost their power over the land as well. So essentially, she's making an argument that the position of women greatly worsened over this period with the rise of capitalism. Attached to that argument, she says that this is how the waged working class was created, not as a multi-gendered working class, but as a male working class, and that women were their subjugated housewives within that. She also argues, and this is really crucial, and this is why I've raised the thing about her disagreement with Marx at the start, is because she argues that there was a potential different outcome to the struggles in the early modern period. That instead of capitalism that we got, that Marx says provides the possibility for the liberation of humanity, we could have existed in the commons, the communes, that there was some alternate path to a kind of peasant communism instead of capitalism. She says, therefore, it's a historic tragedy, actually, that capitalism won out. And this affects what she says needs to happen in the future as well, that there need to be... today's struggles are not about sort of working class against the capitalist class, but about attempts to re-establish communal low-tech commons around the world, basically autonomous struggles of different sections of society. And that's where the autonomism of Federici comes in. She also, in her newer book, and this is missing from her older one, but she talks about witch trials that are occurring again in countries experiencing a new round of primitive accumulation. So she said, particularly in Africa, she talks about the new scramble for Africa, which is very well documented by lots of Marxists as well, and for Asia. Communities that have been basically, since the 80s, subjected to land buy-ups, to structural readjustment programs by the IMF, and to the imposition of market forces in a really brutal way that has basically broken up entire communities. And she says that in order to carry that out, new waves of witch hunts have been necessary in those regions as well. And it's definitely the case. There are there's witch hunting in a bunch of countries around Africa, like Ghana, and so on. So she basically says that globalization and primitive accumulation, they're a continuing process throughout all of history since the early witch trials, and that that is leading to the devaluation of women's social position. Now, lastly, she claims that in terms of going forwards, not just that we need struggles for the commons, but that female power needs to be re-established, reclaimed in the domestic sphere and in the community going forwards. So for Africa, she advises that the feminist movement should seek to empower women, to educate people about the fact that witchcraft isn't real, basically. In the West, that women should demand wages for housework, and that feminists should, again, see their job as trying to reclaim the commons. So she rejects the insistence of Marxists that the working class as a universal class can liberate all of society through a socialist revolution. And often she seems to be rejecting, I think, the fact that the idea that women are an integrated part of that global working class. So a historian talking about Federici says that she changes the conflict between labour and capital to the conflict between capital and commoners. And I think that's a pretty good summary of the difference. So I wanted to go through it. A few facts, first of all. Undoubtedly, lots of elements of this narrative are true, and I'm not trying to say I disagree with all of it. But I think picking a few truths out and ignoring a lot of the historical evidence isn't the basis on which to build an understanding of the past or present. And I believe that Federici does this. A lot of Marxists, feminists, historians have picked her up on that over the past two decades since she published Caliban and the Witch. I think it's a shame then that reading her book from this year, all the same assumptions are still there. So the first thing which I mentioned at the start is the number of witches killed. Again, the most generous estimate is that 100,000 people were tried for witchcraft in the 250 years that we're talking about, starting in the 1500s. So 100,000 people were tried, 50,000 or thereabouts would have been executed. And there is dispute about that, but that is largely the accepted figure. Sometimes Federici seems to count all sorts of other people in these numbers, like heretics who were hunted by the Catholic Church and so on, the early Cathars. But these people, I think, although there's very important similarities between those and the witch hunts, it doesn't help her make her argument. Most of them were not women, or a lot of them were not women. It wasn't a particularly gendered crusade, and a lot of them died in religious wars like the Crusades. So to go through some of her claims in more detail. So she claims that the witch hunts were aimed at subjugating women. So for that, you have to try and explain and understand the fact that they were obviously very gendered for the most part. So there's a few assumptions in there. First of all, that women were perhaps better off under feudalism, which I mentioned before. So I did want to look at the social relations which actually existed in feudal society. So to start with, women and men lived on the land as serfs initially, or later on as smallholding peasants. Now, serfs were essentially owned by their greater landlords, barons, nobles, and so on. They did hold sometimes customary rights within the manor. So the manor was literally like your landlord's house, and you belonged to that landlord. But you could have, you know, if you grew old, too old to do any real labour, the manor would have to give you some resources to continue to live. But women and men were both treated appallingly by this system. Women were especially oppressed within it. It's not the case that they had much power at all. For example, and Federici does talk about this, lords often retained the right to sleep with a woman serf on her wedding night. And the family, as it existed in feudalism, was deeply sexist and patriarchal. There was a family already. It was not the case that capitalism had to totally invent the patriarchal family. It was there from our early class societies. And the control of women's sexuality and the gender division of labour had been central to class societies stretching back to ancient Rome and Greece. And I think all class societies actually that you look at have been premised on both a class and a gender division, as the need for the ruling class to control sexuality and reproduction dictates that it subjugate and control women. And there's no exception to that that I know of. Despite periodic challenges to this norm, obviously people don't just accept this horrific subjugation wholesale, feudal society was deeply sexist. Now, many factors started to throw the feudal systems into crisis. The Black Death and the resultant high cost of labour and the excess of land, the consequent end of serfdom in England and Italy and elsewhere, the rise of trade, of commerce, and the rise of cities as well, as a lot of people escaped poverty in the countryside or sometimes were forced into them by land enclosures. So this increased the power and freedom of peasants and some urban workers as well. It also spurred on massive rebellions because people were very, very sick of feudalism, as you would be, and they also realised they had a lot more power now and you couldn't just fuck with them as easily. So in 1381 in England, there was a massive peasant rebellion. The German Peasant War happened about 150 years after that, and that's sort of around the time that the witch trials started. And Caliban and the Witch, for example, is at times a really beautiful retelling of some of these rebellions. And she really dismisses the myth that these revolts were just disorganised, unconscious, apolitical, and so on. And they were brutally crushed as well. So the German one resulted in 100,000 people being murdered. So the resultant end to serfdom, which is why I raised this, made the population more free to move about. And this sometimes did give women greater freedoms and independence, and that is important to understand. And that was definitely, I think, as capitalism was imposed over the next 300 years, was kind of minimised. But this was always a very contradictory process and a complex one as well. Often women would win new rights as they lost others. The transformation of a population from a bunch of peasants to a bunch of urban workers wrought very, very huge changes for women and for men as well. And actually men lost a lot of their power that they may have, that they had in terms of their access to the commons, their access to land and so on, just as women did as well. Okay. Now, there's another problem in the thing about it being aimed solely at women. It wasn't aimed solely at women, the witch hunts. Now, undoubtedly, the sexist nature of 16th century Europe meant that women were viewed as more susceptible to temptation by the devil, and therefore more likely to be women. The percentage of those executed, like I said, is overall it's majority women. But there were many places like Iceland, Moscow, Estonia, and Burgundy and Normandy, and a whole bunch of places in Germany as well, where the majority of people trialled and executed for witchcraft were men. And some of these places, you could argue, were peripheral to Europe, like Iceland. It's kind of totally irrelevant. But I don't know what was going on there, because like 96% of the people executed were men. So anyway. But the north and centre of France, I think, cannot be just so easily discounted. And a lot of the processes that Federici describes happening as primitive accumulation in a bunch of other countries were also happening in France. And yet, about 60% of the people executed there for witchcraft were men. Now, Federici and other people often dismiss this and just say, well, when they were executed for witchcraft, men were, it was more for like being friends with a witch. This is not the case. A lot of men, and there's fascinating cases that I read, were accused of having sexual intercourse with the devil, flying around on goats and broomsticks, murdering their own children, even making other men impotent with their spells. So there is a sexual politics obviously involved in it, and you can see that there was definitely a Catholic and Protestant hierarchy that were deeply obsessed with whether or not people were impotent and able to have children and stuff. But to say that this is a conscious attempt to subjugate women and force them into a family when a family already did exist, I think is a bit of a stretch. Similarly, writers from this period tended to use gender-neutral terms in their discussion of witches as well. Now, okay, what about the fact that the perpetrators were sort of the whole ruling class of Europe, if you will, church and state? And she's right to point out that various institutions across Europe, both secular and sacred, carried out or supported witch hunts. So I'll talk about those two key institutions. So first of all, the states. Now, the states had a kind of complicated relationship to primitive accumulation in this period, which is a thing you have to kind of understand. Like the English monarchy, for example, acted against land enclosures throughout this whole period. Most of the edicts and laws that they introduced were trying to stop wealthy merchants and wealthy landowners from buying up or just enclosing huge sections of land, because the monarchy saw this as a threat to their, you know, their noble status, and saw it as, the idea that just like plebeian randoms who don't have, you know, aren't blue-blooded could own heaps of stuff was anathema to them. So that's important. There's a whole bunch of different institutions that carried out the witch hunts that were not really pushing primitive accumulation in this period. The states in many areas as well, in opposition to the peasant movements that I mentioned, were starting to centralise. So, you know, they got a bit scared of the kind of challenges to their authority, and they centralised into absolutist monarchies, where power was centred on the king or queen, who was in some cases the head of the church as well. And they created, as part of this process, for the first time, bureaucracies of experts, more extensive court systems, and they enforced laws on larger sections of the population. And these courts were undoubtedly used in the witch trials. So I think partly the extension of the state, the growth of it, its centralisation in a bunch of places can help explain why this was a crazy period of lots and lots of witch hunts, as well as lots of heresy hunting and the courts basically just going berserk. The bureaucracies they eventually set up for witch hunting as well, I think, became quite self-perpetuating as a phenomenon. They had to justify their own existence, so they, you know, kept finding witches everywhere. And it's also the case that the states did start to legislate against witch hunting as it kind of got a bit out of control. Now, the churches were the other witch hunting institutions. The Roman Catholic Church had just spent the previous 400 years conducting religious crusades and inquisitions to root out heretics and witches as well. So Federici is wrong to say that the witch hunts just started in the late 1500s, which she actually does claim. A Dominican friar in the 1300s, for example, early 1300s, reported that he had personally burned 548 people as heretics, mainly Cathars, but also Jews and witches. So witch hunting, again, is not as new as she claims. And a complex mess of political and economic reasons lay behind the early and actually quite common witch hunts against heretics. A pope was even heresy hunted, for example, in the late 1200s, because basically the king accused him of being a sorcerer so that he could... and also said that he had a familiar in animal form in order to discredit the whole papacy and justify higher taxes on church land to pay for a war with England, obviously. So there were lots of cool, fun, kooky ways you could use witch hunts back in those days. But it is important to, in terms of the Catholic Church, to understand that in stalwart Catholic areas like Spain and Italy, they actually had the fewest witch hunts. Where the church just reigned dominant and had successful crusades that had kicked out all the heretics and silenced them for a period, in the 1500s that Federici is talking about, actually they didn't have many witch hunts at all. So that doesn't really help to kind of bolster her argument. And actually, the places where you had the most witch hunts, and Federici never talks about where the witch hunts happened across Europe, she just kind of talks about Europe in general, the places where they were the most was Germany. And Germany was actually quite backwards, relatively, in terms of primitive accumulation and economic development in this period. But it did have one thing going on, which was the Protestant Reformation. So you had Protestant churches and Catholic churches all over Germany in conflict with each other. And I think that you can see how that would start to push towards both churches saying, believe in us. We can, you know, cure you of all your ills. We can kill all the witches. Oh, did something bad happen to your crops? It's the witches. Let us hunt them. And you get a kind of competitive, almost, market for witch hunting. So, yeah, I will move on from that. The other thing is that the biggest body counts of witches in Europe were not necessarily carried out by large and well-funded institutions, but by witch hunter charlatans going town to town and stirring up hysteria. And sometimes the courts of the state actually refused to go along with this. Okay. All right, now the next question is about enclosures. So enclosures is the process by which, like, wealthy landowners enclose with fences, ditches and hedges lands formerly subject to common rights. So places where you could go and catch geese or whatever. These are commonly known through as the Enclosure Acts in England, which didn't actually happen until much later. But the practice of enclosure... Okay, actually, I'm going to skip that because I'm really running out of time. Okay, well, just in terms of the enclosures, I think it's important to say most of the witches were not peasants, actually, and they were not the poorest peasants either. A lot of the time they were the middling sort of people in places like Germany. So there's that. There's also the fact that the trials don't neatly correlate just with agricultural populations that had experienced land enclosure. So there's lots of places where there has been no land enclosure and peasants are just claiming that various people in their communities are witches. So I think it's ambiguous whether or not, you know, Federici's kind of central claim that the primitive accumulation kind of was done through witch trials, that you had to do that in order to demonise and force witches off, force women and the poor off the land. I think there's some factual problems with that. Okay, although I'm sure in lots of cases accusations of dark magic would help people push people off the land. There are a few cases that I found as well. Of that. Alright, well, sexuality in the family is probably the next thing to talk about. So states did, in this time, partly because, like I said, they were becoming bigger bureaucracies, they were taking responsibility for creating laws and edicts that covered more and more of the population. So they did generally enact more laws seeking to control women's sexuality, as did the churches. In urban centres, ruling class fears about idle, unmarried youths often translated into more rigorous ideological pushes around the family. And these really aren't systematised in Europe until much later and well after the witch hunts, when the family and women's role within it becomes a battering ram against an increasingly numerous and rebellious working class in, like, the 18th and 19th century. But again, that's well after the witch trials. It's very possible, though, that the early modern desire to reinforce a partially disintegrating peasant family translated into worries about demonic female sexuality and fueled, I think, some of the ideology behind the witch hunts. Now, Federici claims that women feared but did not participate in the witch hunts, that they kind of had a sisterly solidarity that understood what the witch hunts were about and tried to resist them. And this, I think, is really wrong. Women were the most likely witnesses in witch trials, as often the evidence against the accused involved the exchange of domestic goods, like you poisoned my milk, and they were most often the accusers as well. It is possible that the position of women in society, I think, was lowered throughout the early modern period. Like I said, you have a few centuries, and it happens in different ways, in a complex way around Europe, but you have a huge mass of peasants being forced off their land into general poverty. And because of the sexist nature of both the capitalist society that that was moving towards and the feudal society it was coming from, women, I think, suffered more a lot of the time in that circumstance. But one of the arguments that she makes is that women, the way that women's position in society was lowered was because basically the position of... Because basically that folk healers were pushed, women folk healers were pushed out of that that practice and replaced with male doctors. But there's no evidence to suggest that witch hunts were directed against women folk healers in the vast majority of cases, nor that they were pushed by or endorsed by medical men seeking to replace women. Only 4% of victims in Scotland had folk healing accusations levelled against them. Even fewer of them were midwives, which is another argument that, you know, women were being forced to relinquish their power over their own sexuality through this process. There are also many male village folk healers So the state's centuries-long push to establish the medical profession discredited them over time as well. Okay. Well, the other question is, was there an alternative path or was capitalism inevitable? I think this is a really interesting question in its own right. I don't have time to properly answer it. But I think ultimately... Sorry, I think the heroism of the peasant and urban rebellions in this period are a credit to the people who were engaged in them. And they really kind of dispelled for me, reading about them, the myth that these, this was the Dark Ages, nothing happened, it was all very boring, no one resisted, everyone was dumb. That was not true. The people really fought back in an impressive way. But I think ultimately these movements, as heroic as they were, and often as far and radical as they went as well in their scope, they were incapable of creating the kind of world that they dreamed of, which was a commune of equals. I don't think this is because they were confused about what they wanted or dumb, but because their limited form of social organisation was no match for the combination of the rising bourgeoisie and the nobility at this time. Basically, because the means of production, the level of technology, was not developed enough for them to just be held in common by millions of people across Europe and democratically run by the masses. So at this time, we're still talking largely about low-tech agricultural land rather than the concentrated wealth that exists in modern capitalism, in factories, in major cities, and that can absolutely be democratically controlled by the masses of workers who are today exploited in them. This is not to say that you would not have been a part of these really fun and epic struggles, nor that they didn't, I think, actually play a very important role in sweeping away feudalism, in bringing it into the kind of zenith of its crisis, and actually ushering in capitalist social relations, despite the fact that clearly only a very tiny minority of people actually benefited from the rise of capitalism. Now, I want to talk very quickly about her argument about Africa and today. So there's a few problems with it, because she's basically saying it's related to a new round of primitive accumulation. But the most vicious witch hunts that are happening today are happening in Saudi Arabia. About 500 people are killed in Saudi Arabia every year for being witches, and this has been ramped up in recent years. And Saudi Arabia, I don't think, is experiencing primitive accumulation. I think that would be an extreme stretch. The explanation, I think, for this far more lies in the needs of a brutal capitalist dictatorship, which rules over an extremely exploited mass of people on the basis of a strict and reactionary sect of Islam. And I think the ruling class in Saudi Arabia is deeply cynical about what they're doing there, and clearly recognises the usefulness of like modern heresy hunting, basically, for maintaining the power of the state. And there's, public executions involved in this and stuff, so it's absolutely about striking fear into the hearts of a very exploited and fucked over population. This doesn't fit into Federici's argument at all, I think, because she sees it purely as about creating the, subjugation of women in a round of a primitive accumulation. There's a few other examples and that just give you a sense of the way that ruling classes, especially in the modern era, can very consciously use witch hunts basically as a tool of repression. I think in our modern era we've seen multiple examples of that. The witch hunting of Muslims, essentially, throughout the Western world in the last 20 years, I think gives you a sense of how useful it can be. Okay. All right, well, I just want to talk about the reclaiming the commons thing because I'm really running out of time. So I think there's a few problems with her argument here as well. Firstly, that it kind of has a bit of an essentialism about women, which I think should be avoided by the left. Women are seen as inherent protectors of the commons, as sort of innately earthly beings. One of my real pet peeves when I was a young feminist of 16 was ecofeminism, the idea that kind of springs from this concept that women have a sort of certain innate connection to the earth and to trees and whatever, and that therefore, we are, if we ran the world, basically, it wouldn't be so environmentally destructive. I think that's rubbish. I think there's nothing essential about the categories of men and women, and it is far better for the left to actually understand those categories as totally socially constructed in the interests of our class society. and therefore very changeable throughout history, and I think into the future, very changeable there as well. We should hope for a society in the future where the categories of men and women essentially dissolve and we're all just people. And similar arguments are made by Federici about wages for housework, which is her really famous kind of demand that Maria Della Costa as well was very into. I think this accepts on some level the gendered division of labour, that women should be, well, not confined to, but women's work is in the home, is in the domestic sphere, because that's their natural role, and that the only real problem with that is that it's been devalued, not that there's a sort of division there, and that, you know, women should be atomised baby makers but should be paid for the service, essentially. And again, I think instead that women should be and are part of a massive working class and should fight for free childcare, parental leave for both genders and so on, and ultimately for the total socialisation of reproduction, so that it is no one person's or one gender's role to raise the next generation of people. Okay. I think as well on the commons, it becomes a fairly useless recommendation in developed countries. And a call to see, and often it is, a call to see the main agents of social change as the vanishingly few peasant women that exist in, say, India or Africa, being able to hold on to the commons. The argument that women can only have power or be equal to men if an essentially pre-capitalist society is rebuilt, rather than seeing, again, women as integral to the working class and to a future socialist society in which both men and women are genuinely liberated and can collectively control the forces of industrial production. And so for Federici, this means really often downplaying the role of the working class in liberatory movements, including working class women. Women have always been a part of the working class since very, very early on. And actually the working class, as it was created in terms of the industrial working class in the 18th and 19th century, was men and women and children all shoved into mines, factories, and whatever, pretty indiscriminately, actually. And it took a real conscious effort then, not through witch hunts, but through the moralising about the family, through basically legislating so that women had fewer rights, so that women had to rely on the male wage, deciding to essentially only pay, in some industries, pay men a kind of family wage and force women back into the home. A lot of the time as well, it involved limiting the number of hours that women could work and that sort of thing. So I think that is actually the process by which women were subjugated into the nuclear family, not through the witch hunts. I guess I'll do that. Because I've kind of run out of time, sorry.
Oh, yeah, you're well out.
Okay, well, there's heaps there. I was really excited to give this talk until I started writing it and reading through it. Because, and a lot of people who actually read the book can probably attest that it's a very compelling read. I think, and Federici's a great writer, she's very radical. I think it is an attempt to give a materialist account of the witch trials, and I always wanted that, because I don't know about you guys, but I did a history degree, and you learn about the Salem witch trials, and you're like, what the fuck, that's so crazy, and then it also happened all across Europe, and so I wanted a good explanation for it, and I was sad to find out, actually, that I don't think that that Federici provides one. In terms of your question about alternate explanations, I mean, you probably noticed I don't really have one. I think there are a bunch of different things that connived to create a very kind of disparate, complex thing that stretched over 2.5 centuries. There is not a single explanation for it, which my third year history teacher told me, and I was like, that's stupid, there's got to be a single explanation, but turns out there are multiple things I think that fed into it, and I tried to go through some of them. So the rise of the absolutist state in this period I think is important for it, the fact that you have the rise of big court systems, the centralisation of power in monarchies across Europe, meant that they were just more interested in repressing people generally, and they had the means by which to do so, and so they did. And they didn't just persecute witches, they persecuted fucking everybody for all sorts of different ridiculous reasons. So I think that's part of it. The Reformation is really important, and I tried to talk about that as well. It's very notable that Germany was the centre of the witch hunts, and it was also the centre of the Protestant Reformation. And I think that's not just because Protestantism is inherently anti-witch or something. The Catholics, as Federici points out, lots of the different churches got kind of, you know, came up with their own laws against witches. The Catholics were actually the first people to do that. It was the Malleus Maleficarum was written by a Catholic who was excommunicated for being crazy. Not so crazy 100 years later when everyone was on board with his stuff. So, but I do think that the fact that you had a kind of real, like you were saying, real upheaval, sudden questioning of lots of what had been kind of enforced religious doctrine for centuries that no one was allowed to question, I think did mean that there was more space for sort of magical thinking and for the churches to come in and say, we're your guys, we'll come and do your witch trials for you. Mm-hmm. And there was actual competition. In fact, I wouldn't want to put too much credit into this, but some economists, in their classic fashion, did an analysis of all the German towns that experienced witch hunts, and it correlates pretty well, actually. If there was a Catholic church and a Protestant church fighting for influence over a certain population, lo and behold, hundreds of witches get murdered. So there's definitely something in that, and that doesn't really, you know, have much to do with what Federici is saying. The other thing I think is the repression that's important. The period was marked by really fabulous struggles against feudalism. And I think a bunch of people made the argument, the thing about the KKK popped into my head pretty much the second I started doing this talk as well, because repressing people, terrorising people, is a very useful way to kind of assert control. And definitely for the churches and for some states, they saw this as part of that, although, again, there were many, many ways that they did that. And I think the KKK, just to be clear, the KKK is much more clearly about terrorising and repressing black people, and actually, when I thought about it and compared it, it was like, actually, there's a much more obvious, a conscious way in which the ruling class of America literally donned robes themselves and started whipping up fear and hanging people, and it was directly related to their attempt to basically reinstitute slavery after the Civil War or some form of it. You can't make the same claim, I think, for the witches in Europe, even though, you know, there are some similarities. On social reproduction, I probably don't have enough time to talk about that. I agree with what was said. I think that was perfect, basically, that the labour theory of value is all about trying to explain, actually, the way society functions, that the bosses need to both be able to make a profit, and anything that can contribute to that is really important, and the kind of savings made in the nuclear family were recognised, I think, in the 19th century, and that's why one of the reasons it was pushed. But the other reason is a political one about stability that every ruling class has to care about. It's probably one of the reasons the witch hunts happened. But definitely, I think, the reason why in the 19th century there was this crazed moralistic push to put women in the home was not because they just made a calculation, oh, that's going to be cheaper. It was because they were dealing with, for the first time, a massive industrial working class that would not stop striking, would not stop rebelling, would not stop formulating its democratic and political demands and stuff. And they wanted to tame it and control it. You see that really clearly in Australia with it's pretty much just taken over wholesale and imposed on what was a pretty ratty, kind of uncontrollable working class here that was mainly made up of like convicts and ex-convicts. They were like, we need to tame them, and that means putting them into little nuclear family units where they're responsible for their children, they're responsible for their wives, and they have to just basically sit in a home and go to work and shut up. And it's just a tried and true method, I think, of controlling the population. I think that helps explain it, and that you can get with Marxism, and I agree, most of the attempts to alter that or whatever are attempts to move away from its central conjecture that that the working class, both men and women, and women have always been a part of it. I totally reject the idea that they haven't, are the key to human liberation.